Hi everyone, welcome to this session which is about orgs legal work. Thank you very much for making it. I know we're on at the same time as the MPs, but we've got quite a lot of people, so perhaps that shows that politicians are even more unpopular than lawyers, I don't know. not sure. But thank you very much for coming. Just one housekeeping point, that there may be photographs being taken. So if you don't want your photograph taken, could you sit at the back, please, if that's all right? The format of the session is that I am going to speak first. I'm Elizabeth Knight. I'm Org's Legal Director. I'm going to talk about recent developments in data retention and what Org's been doing to try to fight data retention. And then I'm going to pass over to Dan Carey. Dan Carey is a solicitor at Dayton Pierce Glynn. He has a lot of experience in working on civil liberties, human rights claims. At present, he is advising us both on the Privacy Not Prism claim before the ECHR and also in our data retention work. So he's going to talk about the Privacy Not Prism claim, and then at the end we'll both do some questions. So data retention, it's going to be a general overview, so apologies to those of you who already know a lot about it, but first of all, what is data retention and why does it matter? When we talk about data retention, we're talking about the who, the when and the where of communication. So we're not talking about content, we're talking about metadata or communications data. Retention is the obligation on service providers to retain data on their customers for longer than they ordinarily would for business purposes. And why does it matter? The government's keen to emphasise that because it's not content, it's not that important. But actually, when you piece together all of these pieces of information, you can actually build up a very intimate picture of a person's life, of their habits, their social circles, their political views. I mean, an often given example is if someone's contacting Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't need to know the content of the communication to make an assumption about a person. Having blanket data retention does create a feeling of universal surveillance. It's an interference with our right to privacy, and it also has a chilling effect on free speech. Fighting data retention is not something that's new for Org. It's something we've done since the start, really, long before I started, which was only a few months ago. But back when Org was founded, fighting the debate that led up to the Data Retention Directive was one of the key reasons for the formation of Org. One of our first campaigns was against the marching through the European Parliament of the Data Retention Directive. We were promoting Digital Rights Ireland's challenge to a UK audience, and we joined the movement that was coordinated by EDRI, European Digital Rights, to fight the directive. Then in, I think it was 2008, we were one of 43 NGOs that filed an amicus curiae brief in the first challenge to the Data Retention Directive, arguing that it was incompatible with the rights to privacy and freedom of expression. Then we also protested when it was transposed into UK law, making a submission to the Home Office saying that it was had a questionable relationship with basic human rights. And then later we were also involved in the fight against the Communications Data Bill, or Snooper's Charter, with Jim giving evidence that the Parliamentary Committee was making submissions to the committee, which ultimately criticised the bill, and it was shelved. So fast forward to April 2014 and victory for Digital Rights Ireland. We do have some people here from Digital Rights Ireland, so you may have been in the talk earlier, which is a really interesting talk about that. In Digital Rights Ireland, it was a landmark decision at the CJEU, the Court of Justice of the European Union. They found that the Data Retention Directive was invalid. It breached our fundamental human rights to privacy and protection of personal data under the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights. They said it was a particularly wide-ranging and serious interference with those rights, and it was disproportionate. They set out several reasons that the directive was disproportionate. I won't go through them in a lot of detail, but I'll just go through them quickly, because what they were doing there was really setting out the permissible limits for data retention under human rights law. Importantly, they said that there has to be some kind of relationship between the data that was retained and public security. So rather than just retaining everything, the data should be restricted either to a particular geographical area, to a particular time period, or to people who were under suspicion for some reason, or at least the data that there was reason to think it would be useful for investigating serious crimes. They said you should differentiate between different types of data, and the retention periods should be tailored accordingly. They said that retention periods should be no longer than strictly necessary. There should be exceptions for data subject to professional secrecy. In terms of access, they went on to say that there should be some kind of judicial or independent body making decisions on access. That access should be limited to when it's strictly necessary, to narrower purposes, and the number of bodies that are able to access the data should also be limited. They also said that safeguards should be applied to the data, that it shouldn't be transferred outside the EU, it should be destroyed as soon as possible, need safeguards against abuse. So really, that they set out quite a clear template for what kind of data retention would be allowed. In the aftermath of the decision, Org intensified its work on data retention. As I said, Dan was acting for us and was writing to the government. We were hoping to challenge the UK implementing legislation, which was then the Data Retention Regulations 2009, which in our view were unlawful for the same reasons as the Data Retention Directive was, and also were arguably void or voidable, depending on your point of view. It did transpire that there was an existing judicial review in place, which had been in place before the decision, and so at that point we were considering making a third party intervention, and we were discussing that with other NGOs. We were also at the same time doing some campaigning work. We encouraged supporters to complain to their ISPs to tell them to stop retaining data. We had about 1,600 people do that, so that was very helpful. But then of course suddenly a drip happened. It feels like there should be dramatic and foreboding music at that point. I'm sure you all know, but on the 10th of July, the government announced that it was bringing forward emergency legislation. There had been rumours for a couple of days previously, and we'd been involved in preparing briefings with Liberty and other NGOs for MPs for why any new legislation should comply with the CJEU judgment. But as you may know, when DRIP was introduced, it was said by the government that it was an emergency, but it was quite a convenient emergency, because actually there'd been 3 months since the CJEU decision, and it just so happened that the emergency distilled just a few days before the parliamentary recess. So that meant that there was only 3 days allowed for debate. The bill was pushed through very quickly. Some people thought that it denied the Parliament the ability to properly scrutinise the legislation. That was certainly our view. Tom Watson, MP, said, I think it was a democratic banditry resonant of a rogue state, which was a very eloquent way of of expressing our opinions. The government paradoxically maintained both that the previous regulations remained in force and that there was no problem, but they also said that if we didn't act straight away, then the ISPs would start deleting the data. So that was the reasoning for the emergency. Moving on from the process, the substance of DRIP was actually more concerning. It had already been found that the Data Retention Directive breached our fundamental rights to privacy and protection of personal data, but actually the new legislation is almost exactly the same as the old legislation, except now it is primary legislation, which means it's more difficult to challenge. The government had been given a clear template, but it chose not to comply with it, and in our view that could be seen as an attempt to circumvent the decision of the CJEU. There were some minor improvements. For example, the retention period was changed from 12 months to a maximum of 12 months, which means that in theory the data retention notices that are issued could specify a shorter period, but because we don't actually get to see the notices because they're secret, then we don't actually know whether that's happening in practice. As well as breaching our fundamental rights in that way, the government said it didn't introduce any new powers, when in fact that's simply not the case. as well as reintroducing the old powers, it also made changes to RIPA, the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act. And it did that in two ways. First of all, it stated that RIPA was to have extraterritorial effect, meaning that now interception warrants and requests for access to communications data can be served on overseas service providers. And it also changed the definition of telecommunications service, meaning that web-based services such as Hotmail and Gmail are now also caught. For us, this represented an extension of surveillance powers at a time when they should be being scaled back to comply with a human rights judgment. There's also the risk, as was expressed by some academics, that this could provide justification for other governments around the world to introduce similar legislation, and that some of those governments could be keen to reduce freedom of expression online. And there's also the risk of developing conflicting jurisdiction where ISPs and service providers may be subject to an obligation to provide information under UK law, whereas under the law of the country in which they're based, they might be under an obligation not to disclose that information. So there's certainly a potential for difficulties there. Moving on to legal challenges, I mean, in our view, DRIPA, as it now is, the Data Retention and Investigatory Powers Act, is wide open to challenge on the same basis as the previous legislation. As soon as it was passed on the 17th of July, we started considering with Dan what we could do to challenge it. We were planning to bring our own judicial review claim initially in the High Court, but then on the 22nd of July, it was announced that Tom Watson MP and David Davis MP were planning to bring a judicial review themselves, advised by Liberty, acting for them as their lawyers. This obviously meant that we needed to change our strategy somewhat, because there was a risk that if we filed a second judicial review, it probably would have just been stayed by the court, which means put on hold behind their claim. And obviously that would entail a waste of time and resources really for us. So we started to consider making a third party intervention. There are some advantages to that. For example, the cost consequences are lower, but there are also some difficulties, meaning that we wouldn't be in control of the case. We wouldn't get to make all of the decisions. At first, it appeared that the MPs might just be focusing on ECHR convention arguments and not EU law arguments. And at that point, we were still considering filing our own judicial review on the EU law issue. But once we received assurances from Liberty that it was going to cover both issues, then we decided that the best use of our resources would be through a third-party intervention in that case. We're particularly keen that EU law data protection arguments are raised, both because Org's done a lot of work on these issues previously and because of our relationship with other organisations in the EDRI network, and we want to ensure that this decision works all over Europe and not just in the UK. The kind of arguments that we're going to be making are in relation to the existing EU data protection regime that was in place before the data retention regulation was in force. So that would be the data protection regulation, the e-commerce regulation, and the data protection directive, the e-privacy directive, and the e-commerce directive. And the exceptions that are contained within there, we'll be arguing that that the new legislation doesn't fall within those exceptions. We also intend to provide comparative information from other EU jurisdictions as to what's happened since the CJEU decision. For example, in Austria, Slovenia, and Romania, data retention has been found unlawful since the CJEU decision, and that's on top of other countries that had already rejected data retention previously, such as Germany before the CJEU decision. The process that we're going through is we've been in touch with both parties. We've got the MP's support in making a third-party intervention. The government has said that they won't oppose us and that it agrees that we shouldn't be subject to costs for making an intervention. The present situation is that we've made our application. You need to get permission from the court to make a third-party intervention. So we're waiting for that currently. unfortunately, as I said, it's not in our hands. We have heard that the initial decision didn't go the way of the MPs and Liberty, which means we have to have an oral hearing to decide whether they have permission to proceed with their claim. So that's happening quite soon. We're applying to make written submissions for that hearing. So we will keep you updated as we can. And we're also considering what other legal challenges we could bring. Dan spent quite a lot of time looking into this. There are other potential avenues. Individuals can make damages claims against the government for their failure to properly apply EU law, but the difficulties there are probably in terms of the cost consequences for individuals, which might make that very difficult to do. We also considered challenging the extraterritoriality aspects of DRIPA. What we would probably need there is an overseas ISP or service provider who's angry about these obligations. We haven't yet found one to be the claimant, so if anybody knows of one, then please do let us know, because we'd be very grateful for that. The other possibility, really at EU level, that the EU Commission could bring infringement proceedings against member states, so they could do that against the UK and other member states for a failure to properly apply EU law. But the problem there is it does rely on the EU Commission deciding to do that. So EDRI are quite involved with trying to put pressure on the Commission to get them to do that, and we'll be involved as much as they need us. The other thing happening at EU level is we're keeping on our out for whether there'll be a new data retention instrument. Certainly the new Home Affairs Commissioner has said that he thinks that there is a need for a common instrument. So we're going to keep an eye on that. So to finish, really, unfortunately, we don't have a big victory that we can tell you about, unlike in the Digital Rights Ireland talk earlier. We have been plugging away. It has felt a bit like we're banging our heads against a brick wall sometimes. But we are going to continue to try. We think it's particularly important, as Theresa May has recently said, that she thinks we need more data retention. We need a new communications data bill, new snoops charter. You may also have seen that communications data has been in the news a lot recently as a result of journalists having their phone records accessed and email records accessed. But we think that the media coverage is focused far too much on those on the access to those to that data, without really thinking about why the data is available in the first place. And actually, if we didn't have blanket data retention, then that data just wouldn't be there to be misused in that way. So that's why, as part of the Don't Spy on Us coalition, we are campaigning for wholesale reform of this area. We think that we need a comprehensive new surveillance law. We're asking for repeal of DRIPA and RIPA, and to replace them with a new law which is targeted, both in terms of targeted interception and targeted retention of communications data. And then we're also asking for judicial authorization of access to both types of data. So thank you very much for your support in org's legal work. We will continue, and we hope that we will manage to ensure the government complies with its human rights obligations, and that the law comes in force in line with the CJEU ruling. Thank you. So Dad's going to talk about privacy, not prison.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Yeah, I'm going to talk about ORG's complaint to the European Court of Human Rights. So this is about the Edward Snowden disclosures. It's about surveillance, and it's about content rather than metadata. So I'm kind of turning the clock back to this time last year, when Glenn Greenwald was still sort of drip-feeding all these revelations about what GCHQ and the NSA and other security intelligence services had been up to. One of the most alarming aspects of the Snowden disclosures was the failure of the legal framework around the activities of the intelligence services. And that failure was sort of right through the system, the failure of Parliament to circumscribe what the executive was doing, the failure of the executive to adhere to those laws, the failure of the courts to enforce those laws, And then the failure of oversight mechanisms to alert any of us to even the slightest hint of what was happening. And in fact, what the Snowden disclosures showed and the reaction to them was that really outside a very small group of civil servants, the Parliamentary Intelligence Services Committee, and even within that committee, it seems some members weren't as au fait with what was going on as other members. And a few select ministers outside that very little group, nobody really knew what was happening. And GCHQ knew that that they would be liable to criticism if this got out. There's a very telling quotation from one of the Snowden disclosures as follows. "Our main concern is that references to agency practices, i.e. the scale of interception, could lead to damaging public debate, which might lead to legal challenges against the current regime. The scale of interception and retention would be fairly likely to be challenged on Article 8 right to privacy grounds." And that was a GCHQ internal memo. Well, they were right, of course. An ORG's challenge in the European Court of Human Rights followed. Briefly, what I'll talk about then, I'll touch very briefly on the Edward Snowden disclosures, but I'm assuming most people are familiar with those. And then the kinds of legal challenges which could flow from those disclosures. And then I'll talk specifically about ORG's legal challenge. And then finally, just what's the current status is and what happens next. So firstly, then the disclosures themselves. As well as the PRISM allegations and the Tempora programmes, it's worth remembering that there have been various other very worrying practices which are now in the public domain, so GCHQ using malware to specifically attack systems overseas, British facilities around the globe, so not just GCHQ in Cheltenham and in Bude, in Cornwall, but also facilities in Cyprus, and no doubt also all the sort of British overseas territories like Diego Garcia and St. Helena, they're all tapping into the sort of global network of fibre optic cables. The cracking of common encryption standards, of course, and the subverting of those standards through what sounds like some very old-fashioned spying techniques, literally sort of planting personnel in the companies that have been formulating those standards, the NSA sharing data with other states like Israel. So if we're sharing our data with the US, they're sharing it with Israel. You know, who are Israel sharing it with, etc., etc. GCHQ boasting to the US of the lax legal regime in the UK. Also the NSA DishFire program, which gathered all SMS data en masse, the Optic Nerve program, which gathered webcam information over a very long period of time, and then the Mystic program, which recorded all the phone calls in several unnamed countries, I think one of which was Afghanistan. So those are the disclosures. In terms of the legal challenges that could be brought, it's worth saying, first of all, that all of the security services conduct in the UK is supposed to be on the basis of and within the terms of powers given to them by Parliament. That didn't used to be the case, but it has been since the Intelligence Services Act. So principally, that's two pieces of legislation, REIPA, Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act, and the Intelligence Services Act. REIPA covers interception, requests for data, that have been retained by third parties, surveillance, and then other kinds of spying techniques like human intelligence and planting of undercover personnel, things like that. The Intelligence Services Act covers kind of anything else, so probably things like those malware attacks. They don't really fall into any of the categories under REIPA, so they, we assume, must have been authorised under the Intelligence Services Act. REIPA itself, it was passed in 2000 when less than 20% of the UK had an internet connection. The bill was certified as human rights compliant by none other than Jack Straw, who's a sort of I don't know, sort of Walter Mitty character who just sort of turns up in the background of all of the UK's human rights violations of the last 15 years. Extraordinary. Jack said at the time, "I accept that there are complications in the techniques, but it is not impossible and a great deal of work is going on. Some parts of internet communications can be intercepted at the moment." So that was what the minister told Parliament in terms of what technological capabilities were at the time that the Act was passed. The Act itself is almost unusable. There is a journalist writing about Section 8.4 REPA, which governs the interception of external communications, and he said as follows, "Interpreting that section requires the unravelling of a triple-nested inversion of meanings across six cross-reference subsections linked to a dozen other cross-linked definitions, which are all dependent on a highly ambiguous notwithstanding." and he's right, it's incredibly complicated. A lot of people suspected some of the practices that were going on, and they knew really that REPA was inadequate, but the history of legal challenges in the area of surveillance is that the legal challenges are sparked by a moment when the mask slips and something gets out into the public domain to enable you to challenge it, and that's what the Snowden disclosures did. So the legal challenges that could be brought basically split into two categories. You could either challenge the lawfulness of the framework itself for enabling this to happen, or you could challenge specific practices as breaching the existing framework. And you could do that based on three main sources of law, really: the European Convention of Human Rights, or EU law, which includes data protection law, or domestic common law. And the way that you could bring such a challenge is through judicial review, which is the means by which you complain to a domestic court that the government has acted unlawfully. It's perhaps been surprising that there's actually been very few judicial reviews brought since the Snowden disclosures, and the reason for that is within REPA itself, Section 65 REPA sets out the jurisdiction of the Investigatory Powers Tribunal, which is a tribunal specifically set up under that piece of legislation to receive complaints about the activities of public authorities in the surveillance area, and so all ECHR based claims are diverted to that tribunal, and its inadequacies are well storied, but in brief, there's no right of appeal, there's no right to a judgment, you're not even told if there's going to be a hearing in your case, and I think the record of decisions is something like, I think there's been 7 or 8 positive findings in relation to over 1,000 complaints to it. So in advising ORG, we were wondering whether we should make a complaint to that tribunal or whether we should challenge the legal framework itself, because the way that the IPT's jurisdiction is framed is such that there's no point complaining to it if you're trying to challenge the Act itself. It doesn't have the power under the Human Rights Act to say anything about that. So we're in an odd situation where the Parliament had blocked off access to the ordinary judicial review courts, but neither would the IPT give us what we wanted in terms of a declaration that the legislation is crap. So we took the slightly unusual step of complaining straight to Strasbourg. And ORG did that with Big Brother Watch, English Pen, and an activist from Germany, Constanze Kurtz of the Chaos Computer Club. The complaint was lodged in August 2013, and it's a complaint based on Article 8 of the ECHR, the right to privacy, which isn't an absolute right, but it permits interference with that right only in certain circumscribed situations, so where it's necessary and it has to be done in accordance with law, and the interference has to be proportionate. So the case focuses around whether what has been happening fulfills those criteria, we say it doesn't. And we focused on two key issues. Firstly, the PRISM programme, so the use of material obtained by third states that's then passed to the UK. We say that that doesn't qualify as interception under the legislation. It's neither is it a request for metadata, which is governed in another part of the legislation. So it's effectively, statute is completely silent on regulating how government requests data that the US has obtained through its PRISM program or from other sources. So we say obviously that's not in accordance with the law, and the law must regulate that. It was interesting when William Hague stood before Parliament only a few weeks after the Snowden disclosures. He said to Parliament that it was all fine that the use of the PRISM programme was in accordance with the law, because when requests had been made for information, they checked and an interception warrant had been granted for those requests. But the point is, the law as it's currently drafted doesn't require the government to do that. GCHQ has just sort of made up a policy that they would do that, and it also doesn't answer the question whether, for example, the US just sort of passes information to us. Perhaps we've hinted that we'd like it, but we haven't formally requested it. All that is going on in a sort of legal no man's land. And of course, at the security services facilities like the one in Cornwall, probably in Cheltenham, and Menwith Hill in Yorkshire, the NSA have a lot of people there. They're working sort of right next to the GCHQ staff, so it's going to be very easy to make such sort of informal requests for information. So we say that as it's not governed by legislation, it's not in accordance with law, and it's therefore a breach of all of our right to privacy. Secondly, we focused on the Tempora programme, which, as you probably know, is the interception of pretty much all the internet data that's coming in and going out of the UK by tapping the undersea cables, storing it, sifting through it, using keywords. And the government have used the definition of external communications in REPA to give them a much laxer way of analysing that data. Then, because the communications are external, they don't have to get an individualised warrant in relation to any search. So we say that that's disproportionate, and similarly is not in accordance with the law, because it's basically done on the basis of a series of rolling warrants every 6 months. A lot of papers pass the Home Secretary's desk, and I'm sure she takes her duty very seriously, etc., etc. But every single time she's obviously going to sign it, and there's no other way that she could not, really. So the law needs to take an approach similar to the one taken in the Digital Rights Ireland case and start to require individualised warrants and to get a grip on this mass storage and sifting of data, because at the moment the law is completely inadequate. So that the only safeguards that we as the public the only thing we can rely on is technological limitations. At the moment they can only store, well, this is a couple of years ago, 30 days data. Now it's probably 60 days. 60 days of data, and in 10 years' time, maybe they'll have found a way to sort of, store a whole year's worth of data, and that's obviously completely inadequate. The law needs to regulate this, not technological limitations. And then, thirdly, in relation to both those matters, we make criticisms of the oversight mechanisms in the UK, which is through a series of part-time retired judges, and then the Intelligence and Security Committee in Parliament, which is staffed by, well, as you probably know, sort of fully paid up members of the establishment, and obviously is not fit for purpose. Otherwise we wouldn't have needed Edward Snowden to even give us a hint of what's been going on. So what does ORG want from the case? Well, they want a change in the law, obviously. And historically, that is how the UK legislation has always happened in this area. REPA itself was a response to earlier Strasbourg cases. And it just seems that maybe it's a cultural thing in the UK, or maybe it's wider than that, but politicians just don't have the bottle to effectively regulate what our intelligence services do, and it's only through the European Court of Human Rights that the legislation has improved at all. So back in 1984, there's the case of Malone, who was a convicted, he stolen antiques. He was an antique dealer dealing in stolen goods. And in the course of the case, he noticed that the police notebook had indicated that his phone calls had been intercepted. So he challenged that, because at the time there was no Act of Parliament which regulated that at all. It was done under the Post Office Act, but there was no effective regulation at all. So in response to that case, we got the Interception of Communications Act 1985, but that itself was inadequate, and we then had the case of Halford in 97, who was a senior policewoman who was bringing a sex discrimination claim and suspected that her telephone calls were being tapped. So she made a complaint, and the European Court found that the 1985 Act was inadequate for, at least as it applied to internal government communication systems. And then after that, we had the Liberty case in 2008, which took a long time to come to judgment, so was still concerned with the pre-REPA legal landscape. That was an interesting one about this bizarre tower that MOD built in Cheshire, coincidentally between two signal masts which dealt with all of the phone calls going in and out of Ireland. And even, there's an amazing documentary online where they sort of asked the villagers, you know, did you not wonder what that weird massive mast was, you know, this sort of silo that was built on the side of the outside their village? And they all just sort of, nobody questioned it, they all just thought, well, we thought it was something to do with the industrial estate or something. And the thing was perfectly in the sight line of these two masts and was just hoovering up all the telephone calls. So Liberty challenged that, indeed, the European Court of Human Rights said that nature of surveillance was disproportionate under Article 8. We had the REPA Act by that point, and it certainly seems that in the wake of the Edward Snowden disclosures that changes to the law are more than overdue, and that's what we hope to get out of the case. We hope that the court will go further and actually give guidance to the UK government on what the right to privacy requires, and we're pushing very much the international principles on the application of human rights to communication surveillance, which are really worth a look if you haven't seen those online. They've got a really catchy website, but I've forgotten the name of it. I'll try and remember it. In terms of where the case is at then, finally, we had a very good start. The case was prioritised, which is very rare for the European Court of Human Rights. There's sort of, you know, the percentage of cases that get that are in single figures. The case was communicated to the UK government in virtually record time. I think we lodged it on a preliminary basis in August last year, and then we made good on our submissions with a much lengthier submission in September. And it was January this year, only a few months later, when the court communicated it to the UK government. So the next step was for them to make their formal response in the case. The bad news, however, is that the government have got the case adjourned, while the IPT complaints, which other organisations have lodged, having taken the view that they should at least go through the motions of using the domestic regime while we wait for judgment in those cases. So the latest estimation is that there'll be a judgment in the start of next year, and then we should get going again. The court are still monitoring the situation. They wrote to the government only last week asking for a response by Monday. as to where the IPT complaints have got up to. So we're gearing up to hopefully get going again early next year and pursue the case to a judgment. In terms of how long that will take, probably 6 months for further submissions and then probably another 6 months for a judgment. So end of 2015, start of 2016. I'm afraid that's really quick. that's all I've got to say about the case, and happy to answer any sort of techie questions, or if people want to talk about the principles more broadly or other legal challenge ideas or whatever. Thanks
very much. Does anyone have any questions?
I've been struck by both what you said today and some of the earlier talks that were very reliant on EU law, particularly the Human Rights Act, and there is obviously a movement in the UK to leave the EU potentially or repeal the Human Rights Act. If that happens, what happens to the current cases that are under review? And also, what's your feeling on our future if we cannot challenge these things with domestic law?
I think if we left before we got a judgment, that's a really interesting conundrum. I think technically if we there's two issues: leaving the Council of Europe and therefore the ECHR, and then there's leaving the EU and the jurisdiction of the Court of Justice of the EU. So that this complaint, the ORG complaint to the European Court of Human Rights, that's under the Council of Europe system. So I don't know if, even if we left the EU, we would leave the Council of Europe. But supposing we did, and it was before the judgment, I think technically, as a matter of kind of international convention law, we'd no longer be bound by its judgment. But I suspect the court would still want to reach its conclusion. So we probably have this weird situation of a judgment out there under which we weren't required to observe because we'd left the underlying convention. So I think we'd then have to, with our judgment in our hand, go before an English court and say, well, look, this is bizarre that we want you domestic courts to now enforce this, and we'd probably end up with another series of arguments which would go all the way to the Supreme Court in the UK. But it wouldn't be devoid of utility.
Another one at the front.
What bearing could the IPT judgment have on Strasbourg? What sort of influence might it have? Because surely it's doomed to fail, I would have thought.
The IPT one? Yeah.
Or maybe I'm a bit pessimistic.
Yeah. I suppose it could have two implications. Firstly, the government say that we should have quotes exhausted domestic remedies before we'd gone off to Strasbourg. We have a very clear answer to that. There's a previous European Court of Human Rights cases which say you don't when you're trying to challenge the legislative regime. But if the IPT came up with a sort of half decent judgment, the government would try to win on that exhaustion of domestic remedies point. I don't think they would succeed on that, but they'll have a go. But then, putting that to one side, what impact it would have in terms of the actual judgment that the European Court of Human Rights gives, I think they'll be deferential to it, but unless it fulfills the sort of fundamental complaint of an inadequate legislative regime, it's not going to deal with the core complaint. And since the IPT doesn't have the power to make a declaration of incompatibility, then I can't see how it will meet the court's prime concern. They might sort of try to, although they're prevented from making a declaration of that nature, they might sort of make recommendations to the government that it reform things or something like that, which the court will sort of look at and say, well, that's, thanks very much, but it doesn't stop us from saying what we think. So they'll take it into account, but I don't think it's going to really change what the court says itself.
I suppose the other issue is the if those NGOs that are involved in that case wanted to then go to Strasbourg, whether their case might be joined with our case, which is something we don't know at the moment, so then there could be a possibility of that happening.
Yeah, I mean, if they wanted to sort of join up, that might be quite a good way to sort of unify the two approaches. I think at the moment this complaint's being quite a good lever on the IPT to sort of put out sort of more disclosure in its in the domestic complaints than it otherwise would have done. There's a sort of pressure on them to do more than I think they would have done.
Lady in the blue shirt. I mean, do you mean in terms of oversight or in terms of legislation? It's probably a question that's a bit longer than we have time to answer. I mean, RIPA is supposed to contain checks and balances, but as I think Dan was saying, the oversight regime has proved ineffective, and things like Section 8.4 of RIPA has allowed practices to go on which most people didn't think it was intended to allow before it was passed, and that's another issue, that the legislation seems to have been stretched, doesn't it? The purposes for which it was designed have been stretched by the authorities past their original purpose.
Yeah, I suppose having at least put the intelligence services on a statutory footing in the 90s, we at least have some laws to work with. Before then, it was just a sort of quirk of our constitution that they existed, and there was no way to regulate what they're doing at all. So we've at least got laws now. The Intelligence Services Act, though, is incredibly broad, and as Elizabeth said, the oversight mechanism are inadequate, that being the IPT. In terms of RIPA, there's a bit more substance to it. So in the specific areas that RIPA covers, surveillance, requests for data, use of human intelligence sources, then there's a bit more law regulating what they do. But you're still left with the IPT to enforce complaints against them. So really in reality, the regulatory framework is very weak.
Perhaps have time for one more question, if there is one. Oh, yeah.
First of all, I'm thank you for today for myself or everybody out here. But one problem and my question is a question. I suppose that it's a bit different. That's something that your idea, people has got idea, and they talking about. Anything that's not done said and disclosure is about to be used. But around 6-7 years ago, until now, I knew about myself. I'm here as a journalist, writers, Iranian, chronicles, publishers. But I don't feel good feeling, actually. I don't have a good feeling about my condition, my situation here. I come from the dictatorship country, but there is no difference for me. Any conversation, any argument, any books, any ideas I have, in 6-7 years I know I'm definitely is not the checkmate method. I don't know who's the name, but everything is going to control. And in fact, will be published with other person, with other names. I can show my books, I can show my article, I can show my beginner notes, and will be published in interview, radio interview, in different articles. Is that any rule? Is that any judgment to stop that and support someone like me? Because I don't know what to do. Who's responsible? Who supports me? I can't go back to my country. And I can't say in this situation. Please. complete is a different. We're talking about the net, we're talking about the mobile, we're talking about the TV, about the Facebook, about everything.
Maybe I should have a word with you after this session. I mean, this is the problem that we're talking about, though. I mean, the only avenue people have is the IPT, and you just sort of make your complaint into a black hole and you don't really see it again. So there is a real problem about being able to complain about things in this area. Just one other thing on Reaper as well, the sort of whether the intelligence services are constrained at all. I think one of the big problems that we have here is that it's ministers who are signing off all the warrants. One of the things we say in this case is that it needs to be independent judges and not the ministers who are interested in obtaining that data, because they're obviously not impartial enough to make a judgment about the proportionality of any warrant that they issue.
That's great. Well, thank you very much for coming, and thanks very much for your questions, and we'd also like to thank Dan for all his work for org. So thank you.